Calling all small firm architects. It's time to tap into your full potential with Entree Architects Context and Clarity, where inspiration meets innovation. Hey, it's Mark R. LePage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my two favorite co-hosts, Jeff Eccles and Katie Kangas, as they bring together authors, experts, and thought leaders for electric conversations with entrepreneur architects around the globe. It's not just a podcast. It's a community where dreams meet action.
There's a simple equation there. And what for me, what that did, just doing that basic calculation, was it allowed me to compare what I had actually saved in my retirement accounts to what I thought a possible projected annual spend might be.
Artists are temperamental, so beautiful design is going to be a priority. When the job is done, we're going to actually need to live in the house, not live with the person who designed it. And so for me, the artistic skill, the architectural skill is most important. And so I would say like that would be 60% of it, if not more.
Gain insights to build a successful practice. Subscribe, engage, and let's redefine your future together. Join the Context and Clarity community, where every conversation adds to your blueprint for success. Before we get started, I am very excited to announce that Graphisoft is now an official partner of Entree Architect and the Entree Architect community. I've been meeting with the Graphisoft team for months preparing for this partnership, and I can confidently say that our friends at Graphisoft are fully committed to supporting our architecture firms and our transition to ArchiCAD and BIM. ArchiCAD BIM software enables design, collaboration, visualization, and project delivery, no matter the project size or complexity, with flexible licensing options and a dedicated support team to guide us along the way. ArchiCAD is an ideal choice for firms and projects of any size. And that's why I am personally committed to finally making the move to BIM myself, from CAD to ArchiCAD. And I'll share more about that as I progress. I'll keep you updated. So regardless of which design software you're using today, I encourage you to reach out and talk to the team at Graphisoft by visiting our own dedicated webpage at graphisoft.com/US/EntreeArchitect. There's even an exclusive special offer waiting for our community of architects. So go now to graphisoft.com/US/EntreeArchitect and see how Graphisoft is positioned to help make your architecture firm a success. That's graphisoft.com/US/EntreeArchitect. Now, let's get on with the show. My name is Mark R. LePage, and you are listening to Entree Architect Podcast, where each week I speak with inspiring, passionate people who share their knowledge and expertise, all to help you build a better business as a small firm entrepreneur architect. Dave Pollard, welcome to Entree Architect Podcast.
Thanks, Mark. Great to be here.
Great to have you here. This is going to be a fun conversation. I'm very interested in what your company is doing these days, how you got to where you are today. I'm looking forward to this conversation. Let me introduce you to our audience. Dave Pollard is an architect, a builder, and co-founder of Live Companies, a full-service residential design build company in the Chicago suburbs. LiveCo, as they call it, is doing things a bit differently. LiveCo was created to streamline the process through a single-stop, full integration of design and construction. So they're architects and builders, and they're offering the whole package to their customers. That's something that architects talk about a lot. A lot of us want to do that. So I'm really looking forward to this conversation with you, Dave, about how you got to where you are. Maybe you'll inspire some architects who have similar thoughts on how they could do the same thing. And so I'm looking forward to this.
Yeah, absolutely. My kind of origin story, I guess, is probably like a lot of architects out there, as a kid, I just loved making stuff. So I was always tinkering, building, taking apart my brother's stereo equipment. Very curious, like to make, love to draw. And I don't know how it kind of got into buildings. I think I loved cars, things of that nature. And at some point, buildings, houses really interested me. So I was always studying floor plans. I mean, just like a total nerd, you know, fifth grade, asked for a drafting board for my birthday. I just love drawing and kind of creating these things, building tree houses, all that stuff. So I think from an early age, I was kind of, you know, somewhat destined to the architectural career path. And my parents certainly supported me the whole way with summer enrichment programs. And, you know, when you're not hanging out with your friends because you're building paper models of houses, you know, your parents want to try and embrace that. So I made my way to architecture school and went to Virginia Tech. And that was absolutely life-changing, because the T-square and all the stuff that I thought we were going to learn about drawing floor plans was thrown out the window. And our first project, first day, we're all sitting there and our professor comes in and puts an onion in front of us. And he says, write 6 pages about this onion. I'll be back in 15 minutes.
Yeah, looking around, am I still in architecture school?
Exactly. Yeah. And I kid you not, like one of my best friends today, he had like a T-square in his hand. You know, he was like, I'm here for architecture school. Let's do some drawing. And so we had to write about this onion. And then he came back out and he's like, why is the onion still sitting there? No one's picked the onion up. Like, what are you guys doing? And so we picked the onion up and then we started thinking about it. And he comes back out and he's like, how come no one's peeled the onion apart? So that was the first step in resetting our minds and everything that we learned in our curriculum, which for me was invaluable, which maybe is why I ended up doing what I am today, which is kind of like, you know, the world is whatever you want to make out of it. It's not necessarily what path you have to take. So I embrace that architecture school culture. I think a lot of people were like, this is just a little bit too weird, but it fit really well with me and kind of set me up for a career path of thinking outside the box and trying to think about things differently. So then, you know, you get out of architecture school, you go work for your first firm. I worked for a small, you know, smaller firm. I think we were like 30 people then. Very hands-on. The partners loved to teach. It was really, really great for me because I learned a lot about the deliverables and the process and even contract negotiations. Like all the partners were really intentionally trying to train us, and the culture was great. Project types weren't really something that I was interested in. So we did some residential, but never made any money on those. So I think I still get together with those partners and I'm like, I don't think you guys ever made a single cent on anything I ever did. But they were like, yeah, you were just there to have fun, right? And keep the energy alive. So I ended up then leaving there after a couple of years, and I went to work for Optima, another kind of life-changing experience for me. So Optima is David Hovey, who's an architect originally from New Zealand, who kind of made his way through Chicago architecture and became a developer. So architect-led development, he's a general contractor, real estate, the whole thing. And I worked there in both Chicago and then moved out to Arizona to work on projects out there. So I got to work in both the design office and on the construction side of things and just absolutely loved it. It was fascinating because we were able to build things that would be really hard to sell or price to a general contractor. Yeah. We could kind of make our own rules. Even the drawing set was really thin, you know, for a 25 story building, you know, you got like 50 sheets because you only needed to draw what you needed to draw because you had this team of architect trained builders who were putting it together. So a really, really fascinating, valuable experience for me. Then as the residential market started to trail out, I went to Getch Partners. So I'm kind of going around the world with different firm types. So Getch is a, you know, internationally renowned mid-sized firm out of downtown Chicago, and old school Murphy Yon lineage to Jim Getch, who does incredible buildings, international work. We were really, really busy, but it was there where I learned that much more professional sophisticated level of architectural firms that just wasn't for me. I couldn't really grasp the scale of the projects. I consider myself a pretty good designer, but designing a lobby that has 200-foot ceilings in Abu Dhabi was like, I can't, like, my brain can't visualize it. I can't sleep about it at night. So I'm going through this whole thing and I'm like, what am I just going to be, you know, leading a design, some sort of a project team designing high rises? I really like houses. How do I just design houses? That's all I wanted to do, right? Since the age of fifth grade when I got my drafting board. So how do I be an architect and actually design houses and pay for my kids' clothes and all that stuff? Because I didn't know too many residential architects other than very high-end work. They were actually able to do that. Most of them were kind of working out of their basement, or, you know, really trying to get very high net worth clients, which is a very hard thing to do as well, or they were already independently wealthy. So I was none of those things. So I quit Getch and went back to graduate school. And that was thanks to my wife. She fully supported me because she was tired of hearing me whine about it. And I did a 1-year master's at IIT, and I was trying to figure out how architects can actually be involved in residential housing in any major impactful way. And that's why I studied for a year, and I looked towards technology to kind of solve that and developed a thesis on that front. And then I worked for a small developer where I met my now business partner, and he's a former home builder, and we teamed up and started LiveCo about 10 years ago.
How did you meet?
So he was the director of construction and I was the director of design, and we were a small team. I think it was just four of us, and we were doing ground up single family in a Chicago suburb. And we probably butted heads a lot the first 3 months, or I didn't think we butted heads. He thought we butted heads because I'm like everybody, but he, you know, he's like, the last thing we need around here is another architect. And I'm like, why? I'm trying to help. You know, we have the same goal. And then we'd end up kind of spending more and more time together and realize we were aligned in what we were trying to do, which is, you know, build houses efficiently, make them beautiful, have happy customers, you know, and make a couple dollars doing it. We were just thinking about it in two different ways. So that's how that evolved. And then, we kind of had a no risk opportunity to start a company and doing foreclosure rehab, which is not exactly, you know, architectural, but it's still a lot of problem solving.
Where'd that idea come from?
At that time, I mean, there was the residential market was in the dumps, and we knew people in finance and we knew people out in California that were buying up huge, you know, portfolios of distressed properties and needed them fixed up. We were more professional and shiny. Like, you know, I knew how to use a computer, so I could talk to, you know, high level investment companies. The guys doing the work, you know, they just wanted to do the work. So we kind of orchestrated and built apps and things like that to be able to do remodels really quickly. And we kind of coined the phrase production rehab is what we're trying to do. So we got up to about 30 houses a month. And we did that for about 18 months.
How did you make those initial connections? Where did that network of investors come from? How did you make those connections?
Great question. So Russ, my partner, had a buddy who used to be, I think, with Pulte Homes or something. Mm-hmm. And he was doing it in California, and it was kind of coming to Chicago later.
Yeah.
And so he kind of gave us a heads up on it. It's like, these guys are coming to Chicago, I'll connect you. So, I mean, just like anything else in my life, I think, it comes to just talking to people about what you're doing and what you're interested in.
Right.
And,
yep.
And sometimes the dots kind of connect, you know, one out of 1,000 usually is kind of all you need.
So you're doing these production renovations so you're taking distressed housing, basically renovating it and flipping it, or holding it and renting it?
So we were solely a service provider for the big institutional guys who were doing it. So we had no skin in the game other than like a 6% margin.
Yeah.
Right. It was great. But it was an instant company, and we had, you know, we started the whole company with $5,000 in order to get our liability insurance and some business cards.
So what were they flipping them, or were they holding them?
They were holding them to rent. Yeah.
Got it.
So they packaged them and turned them into the residential REITs, and Okay. Went public and all that stuff.
So that gives you a foundation. Well. That gives you an excuse to start a company, doing what you want to do, and a time that probably was difficult to do other things. And so it gave you that first step into being independent and doing things your way. And so you and your partner started this company to do that work?
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, it's somewhat organic or opportunist, right? You know, instead of saying, hey, this is what I want to do. I want to design all these incredible houses for these people and start from nothing and wait 3 years to have the first. We had kind of service work and we're able to learn along the way. You know, you don't see any of those projects on our website, but yeah, I mean, it's an interesting way to get started.
That's exactly why I like talking about those early days, right? Because architects are listening. Some of them are thinking about starting their firms. And we all have the dream, right? Of having the perfect firm, designing the perfect houses for the perfect client, making lots of money and, you know, doing it forever. Right. And that can happen, but it doesn't typically happen overnight. It's an evolution, right? There is some happenstance and some opportunities that come along, but it's about you taking those opportunities and moving to this next step and keep moving towards where you want to go. So how did you take that next step from doing this production work?
So I don't know that I had the confidence to think that whatever I designed was people were going to love and was going to be good. And that's a little bit scary, right? Because someone's paying you all this money and then you're designing something and we were going to build it and then we're going to build it. And like, what if it sucks? You know, like, that's a little terrifying. You're not going to really know that for a long time. So, I mean, I had a lot of experience, but I hadn't built, you know, specifically stewarded start to finish a whole lot of projects. I don't think I ever told anybody that at the time, but I hadn't. So, you know, I think it starts with some friends and family that kind of believe in you. And then we did an addition on our house, to kind of test. And I mean, I think that's true for so many architects. Yep. They're like, Frank Lloyd Wright did it, right? I don't know if you've been to his home and studio, but it's right, just right. a laboratory. He's just testing all kinds of different things and seeing what works. So our house was totally that. You know, I think I had a lot of architect peers or, you know, good friends who are architects. And I was always, you know, getting together with them, seeing what they were working on. Went to, you know, the International Builder Show, trying to see what cool products were out there. So trying to kind of build out my confidence and my ability to do some cool stuff. And then I had the confidence that, yeah, you know what? I think I am actually good at this. I always thought I was, but I didn't want to say that because what if I'm not? And then you do that for a little while and then you eventually learn like, wait, I think I'm good enough at this that people actually pay me more money in order to do this. And that's a slow evolution. Yeah, it was way too slow of an evolution, to be honest. But, a lot of that, honestly, and Russell never listened to this anyway, but, was my partner. I mean, he comes from a world of production home building. I don't think that he believed, because the market that they sold to didn't believe that there was a mass culture of people that was going to pay for, you know, design services, regular people that weren't, you know, high net worth. So I think it was hard to really believe that until we had proof of concept, and then we eventually did, which is what we do now.
But how did you get there though? Because I think Russ's fear is pretty common, right? Architects also feel that way, and we're all trying to figure it out, right? There are many architects, and you're talking to thousands of them, who are residential architects who want to make a living designing homes and making people happy. And so how do you get from that lack of confidence to the confidence to the clients?
Great question. And there's a lot there. One reason we charge a lot more for design now is because we didn't have any choice. Because historically, because we're design build, it's easy to tell yourself, I don't care about making money on design because I'm going to make the money on the build.
You'll make it up in the construction. Right.
Right. I sold that to a lot of my peers. Like, I don't care, you know, as long as my kids, I can buy them a new hockey stick every couple of years, you know, on the build side, I don't care on giving that away. You know, ego aside and all that. I've come back around on that and in a lot of ways. But what happened is when the pandemic hit, all of our construction stopped. I had no revenue, right? I mean, we had a couple projects that we needed to finish up, but everyone else was like, whoa, we're not going to, you know, break ground right now. Let's see what's going on. So that revenue stream stopped. So then I'm like, well, my only way to make any money and not lay everybody off because I have nothing coming in is to sell design. So it's kind of forced.
How big was your team at that point?
I think we were 10.
Okay. And so construction stops. You're like, okay, all I have left is some sort of design service to sell.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And they can either pay me $15,000 to do this piece of it, or I got to let somebody go.
Yeah.
Like if they paid me $750 to do something, it didn't do me any good. Like the numbers didn't work, right?
So how do you make that transition? How do you go? Okay, so the mindset shift happens, right? Okay, I have to shift from construction to design because that's my only opportunity to survive here. What was the first step towards building that into a service, you know, that you can sell?
Exactly. So that's the other part of it, right? Is to have a really clear, I mean, I'll call it a product, but you know, a lot of our product is our process. Mm-hmm. So we have two design steps. We have a feasibility design, which we charge anywhere from $5,500 to $10,500 for that. And it's a very in-depth two design cycle. We do a concept A, get feedback, do a concept B. And it's all three-dimensional modeling, full visualization, and we do budgeting. So it's a pretty intense kind of first dive into design. So we really kind of built that product out over the years, and it got better and better and better. And the better it got, we're like, well, I think this is worth more money now, right? So we don't just do a plan sketch, you know, for $500. People can do that, right? Yeah. The low cost commitment. We do, you know, you're committing to us really seeing if this project is feasible, working through the budget, working through all these aspects of it. And we package that really cleanly. And another key to that is it's very clear that we only do two concepts. We don't show multiple options because it's another place where it just, you know, spins out of control.
And you said that's iterative, right? So you're presenting one design and then going back and modifying that one design.
Exactly. Yeah. So we're getting a huge amount of feedback because we're taking it so far. So if we did three concepts, I can only take each concept a third of the way, right? Or it takes more time. So we do one kind of all-in concept. And I mean, here's another like great pointer that I learned from a sales trainer. Most of the things when you present multiple concepts to people, you spend all this time drawing it and figuring out how to present it. Most of the time that can just be answered by a phone call to them, right? To ask them a question how would you feel if you had to go downstairs to go do laundry?
Yeah.
No. And they're like, oh, no, I never want to do that. And you're like, okay, great. Well, now I don't have to develop that entire thing. So what we learned is there's, and I think our clients are always kind of amazed by it and how often we're actually able to, you know, nail it 90% of the way on concept A, because we can just answer it with questions and then really shape this thing into something really good for them.
Do you have a pre-designed service or pre-designed phase in that service that you're getting a lot of that information before you even start design?
In terms of, so we do a questionnaire.
Yep.
So in our onboarding, there's a questionnaire, whether or not they sign on with us or not, which gives us a little bit of feedback from them.
How deep does that go? Is that just surface, or are you diving into the project and asking questions about the project?
So I think I'd like to redesign it because it's been a long time, but there's some fun things in there, like, you know, what's your favorite season? So we can kind of get to know them a little bit. And, you know, what's your ideal number of bedrooms, right? You know, do you have kids? Do you have pets? We're trying to get to know them, and we've done enough projects where we can kind of find similarities between people. Mm-hmm. We don't necessarily ask about design styles. We can usually get a sense of that pretty quickly, or people are coming to us because of a particular design style. And then my sales call is a 30-minute Zoom. And I feel like I get to know them pretty well there. And that's when I'll ask questions Because usually you can see a real estate listing and get to know the house a little bit. And like, you know, where do you guys eat dinner? Be honest. We eat on the couch. Just tell me you eat on the couch, right? Then we're not going to spend all this time on this dining room space. And then Sarah, our design lead, when she does the field measure, we'll spend about 90 minutes with them as well. And every client's different. Some people will say, you know, just give us what you think, you know, and then give us feedback, because instead of them answering questions, we find it extremely valuable when we present this 100% design package to get really quick feedback from them on like, oh, I hate the fact that there's going to be all these windows looking at my backyard, right? As opposed to talking about that.
Let's take a quick break to say thank you to our sponsors for their support of this episode. This episode is brought to you by FreshBooks. There's a lot to love about being an entrepreneur architect, right? But trying to figure out our financials on our own is not one of those things. Luckily, we have FreshBooks, the all-in-one accounting solution that's built for business owners like us. FreshBooks takes all the not-so-fun parts of running a business, from building and tracking invoices, to managing online payments, to organizing expenses, and automates them with features like the digital bills and a receipt scanner, saving you up to 11 hours a week in the process. It's also super easy to get up and running, and the award-winning FreshBooks support team, they are always available to answer any questions along the way. Compare that to some of the other financial management tools out there. Try FreshBooks for free for 30 days, no credit card required. Go to freshbooks.com/architect to get started today. That's freshbooks.com/architect. So what will you do with 11 more hours each week? This episode is brought to you by RCAT.com. We all have that one story, that one project that had such a unique situation that it required a solution that you had rarely considered before. We share these stories in private professional circles with our friends and our colleagues, but there has never been a collection of these stories of conflict and triumph all in one place until now. Detailed is a podcast series that features architects, engineers, builders, and manufacturers who share their insights and expertise as they highlight some of the most complex, interesting, and oddball building conditions that they have ever encountered, and the ingenuity it took to solve them. Join host Charisse Lakeside, aka CSI Kraken, a senior specifications writer at RDH Building Science, as she uncovers lessons learned to help you navigate similar challenges that may arise in your next project. Detailed, an original podcast by RCAT. Listen and subscribe right now at rcat.com/podcast. That's rcat.com/podcast, ARCAT.com/podcast. Detailed. Every building has a story. This episode is brought to you by the Entree Architect Community Annual Meeting, the business conference for small firm entrepreneur architects. Learn more at smallfirmconference.com. If you could build a business conference for small firm entrepreneur architects, what would it be? Since I launched Entree Architect back in 2012, I've been listening. I've been watching what members want and learning what we need. And in November, we will gather in Austin, Texas to connect, to celebrate, to honor, and to learn. The Entree Architect Community Annual Meeting was inspired, designed, and launched for you. We invited top speakers to share fast-paced, get-to-the-point TED Talk-like presentations that will provide you with the information that you need so that you can build the firm that you want. On day one of the conference, following a lineup of fantastic speakers, we'll discover the connection between mental health and our financial wealth with licensed clinical professional counselor Joyce Martyr. And then we'll be honoring three architect members of the community at the inaugural Entree Architect Honor Awards. On day two, we'll hear from more great speakers, then dive deep into the successful future of our firms with Brian McCartney of ArcMark at a 90-minute strategic planning program. We'll have some fun building models with Kenya and Matt Forget of Sticks and Bricks, and we'll learn from an icon. Gene Cohn, founder of KPF, at the Day 2 keynote. We planned this event to start with an evening reception on Tuesday, November 1st, and end on Thursday afternoon on November 3rd, so that you'll have time to connect with friends post-event to discover the city of Austin and its amazing architectural sites on Friday and into the weekend. We've been approved by the AIA for 12.75 CEUs, and everyone will leave with a cool bag of swag. Whether you're a member of the Entree Architect Community Facebook group, a member of the Entree Architect Academy membership, or a small firm architect practicing anywhere in the world who wants and needs the support and connection of like-minded architects, the Entree Architect Community Annual Meeting Small Firm Business Conference is for you. With generous support from our friends at Monograph, visit smallfirmconference.com now for tickets, and we will see you in Austin this November. That's smallfirmconference.com. Please visit our sponsors today and thank them. Thank them for supporting you, the Entree Architect community. So with that package, how far and how deep do you go into the design? When a client receives the result of that package, are they immersed in that space and understand what it's going to look like? And you said it was 3D, and how far do you go with that? Is that fully rendered so they can really experience what that space may feel like?
Absolutely. Yeah. It's, I mean, we're using SketchUp and the Inkscape plugin, and you can go really far with that. Yeah. And yeah, we're putting people in it for scale and to show energy. We're just like any other architect. We're trying to leverage whatever tools we can to help communicate how we're thinking about how the space feels. So we'll do the walkthrough, because they'll come into the office and we'll put it on the big screen and we'll navigate through it. We do printouts, we do QR codes so they can do VR in the space. Just whatever we can do to help them understand, because we're pretty excited about what we're presenting to them and we want them to kind of get it.
Yeah.
And a floor plan, I always talk about the floor plan too. Like if you were going to buy a house, you know, you wouldn't buy it from a floor plan. You know, you'd want to go see it. So we're trying to do whatever we can to help them kind of feel that.
Yeah. And you get to yes quicker, right?
Absolutely.
The faster they understand the space and say yes or no, the faster you can be finished with the project. And the faster you finish the project, the more profit you make.
Absolutely. And more than me having to explain why I'm putting this door here or doing that.
Yeah.
They're like, that's it. I want that. Give me that. How do I get that? What's the next step?
Right.
You know, it's not always that clean, but yeah, I mean, we're really good at what we do and we get there very quickly. So when they sign on, you know, a month after field measure, they see their future life. And then they have a sense of how much it's going to cost too. Cause that's also part of the huge part of the program that helps give feedback.
Right. Right. So that's a great package. So they have a full design, totally understand exactly what they're going to get. They have a budget that's tied to that. How committed is that budget? Is that a budget, sort of a ballpark of this is approximately how much it's going to cost, or is that sort of a pre-bid for the construction side?
Yeah. I mean, I would consider it a pre-bid because it is detailed and we call it a budget detail. We started doing it. Well, the last couple of years it's been really, really hard. So
right, I'm sure. Yeah.
You know, we're using historic unit costs. We're not bidding anything out, but we're trying to use, you know, previous project experience. And try and, you know, what, cause it's a big question from them always, like, you know, how accurate is this? I'm like, this is as accurate as it is today.
Right. Exactly.
Based on what we know and the assumptions that we've made, but it doesn't help me if we go through all the detailed design and you pay us even more money and then it costs more.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
that is yeah. not
Nobody's happy. You don't get the project. They're unhappy. Not good.
And we work really hard to try and update budgets throughout the project. And right now, I mean, that's like one of the hardest things that we deal with. And people pay us so that we can help guide them. And
yeah,
because they want to build the project.
Yeah. And it sounds like it's such a great idea to sort of put together a package like that, right? So the package is really clear. This is what you're going to get. This is the scope of the work. This is the result of what you're going to get at the end. This is you're going to get a budget. You're going to be able to make a specific decision on whether this is a go or no go project. and you're going to pay for it, right? This is a service that's valuable, right? You're going to get all of this information. And so you're going to pay for it, and you're going to pay a lot for it, you know, relative to what they potentially could get from another architect that may do a sketch for $500 and call it a feasibility study. And so comparing those two, right? That's because that's what they do, right? They're coming to you. They're looking at what you're offering, and they're going to compare it to others if they can find something similar. And they're going to see, well, this is $10,000 and this is, you know, $1,000.
Yeah. So, I mean, some of our competition does that first step for free because it's a loss leader construction. I'm like, call them, have them do it for free.
Exactly.
Why not? Right.
Right. Exactly. That's the answer. Right. Let them do it. Right. If that's what you're looking for, we don't do that.
Yeah, and you can still call me afterwards. Why, like, we used to sell the things for $750, and we're so excited when someone signed on for $750. And basically, they're like, yeah, you're going to do all this for $750? Yeah, I'll give you $750.
Right.
And we didn't make any money on it.
When you started charging more for it, was it a realization that they would pay for it, or was it sort of, let's throw a big number at this and see if somebody would pay for it? How did you get to that higher number? How did you get the confidence to say, yeah, this is a $10,000 service?
Well, I mean, the easiest way to do it is because, I mean, we do T-sheets, so I have everyone's timesheet, so I know how much it costs us to do it.
So it's a calculation.
Yeah. And then, you know, well, holy crap, this costs us, you know, $4,000 to do it. I'm charging $750. What do I need to charge to, you know, actually hit the gross profit that we need, that we do on construction to make this, you know, basically our design team was, I mean, they were in overhead, and our overhead was then over the top. It was crazy. Right. So every time I wanted to hire another architect, it's like, well, we can't, you know, so you end up having to do too much work with too few people because it's not profitable. And then as you actually, you know, run the math and say, this is legitimately how long it takes to do this, and this is how much money we need to make, then you just say, well, this is then what we need to charge. And everyone freaked out at my office. They're like, oh my God, we're gonna go out of business, nobody's ever gonna pay this. And so we put it out there and people paid it.
It's
there's two sides of it, right? So there's the one when you don't have any work, so you're like, well, I'm either going to charge enough to be profitable, or I'm going to go out of business. Or you have so much work and you have backlog and you don't need any more work, so you charge way more, right? Yeah. So there's two relatively risk-free mechanisms in there. I think our earlier increases were based on backlog, like lots of people were signing up. And so we're like, well, might as well charge a little bit more money for it. And then we tested the market and how far they would go. You know, I think I've found 6,500 is a pretty comfortable number for people. When we get to 8,500, that feels more like 10 grand to them. But there's certain projects I just can't do for 6,500. Like, I'll lose money. So,
So that's interesting that part of that decision process is knowing your numbers, right? That's understanding your business, understanding what the profit margin is, what your cash flow is, all of those things that we talk about here on the podcast. That's why you do it, right? So you can have that confidence and say, yes, this is what my service is worth. And so,
absolutely.
And there are clients out there that will happily pay you for it, especially if you're providing exactly what they want, right? When they think about what they want and that package is presented to them, they're like, yes, that's what I want, right? And
yeah, it's problem solving. And so many people come to us with the chicken and egg scenario where they're like, well, I don't know how much it's going to cost to improve my house. How much is it going to cost? I'm like, I have no idea how much it's going to cost to improve your house. Right. You know, you need to, if you're bringing in a general contractor to just tell you how much it's going to cost, they're making a number up. Right. So, you know, you can figure out how much you want to spend and be comfortable with. And then we can create a scenario to see how far you can go with that. Or we can help you guys figure out, you know, what your end game is. On this house, if you're going to be here for forever, and kind of look at the max potential of it, and then we can budget that, and you guys can use that information to do what you need to. I mean, in my first job, we would do feasibility studies for large retail developers, right? They're doing their due diligence on buying a piece of land, and they have to pay an architect to really figure out how many parking spots they can get, how much square footage. Like, it's in the nature of the industry to have to spend money on the due diligence to figure out what your potential is. And that's what we do. And one of those other questions on the questionnaire that's really important, is especially in Chicagoland, is how long do you plan to live in your home?
Yeah.
Because if they say, if they write 1 to 2 years, I was like, why are you doing this?
Yeah.
Right. Just sell your house now. And I had a call with a couple yesterday, and we kind of had that conversation where, you know, I can do the feasibility study for an addition, a whole house remodel, and based on the scale of it, it'd be $6,500. But you guys, everything you're telling me right now is like, you don't necessarily like the block you're on, because there's a lot of traffic, you know, and you don't want to live there for forever or even necessarily for 10 years. So why don't you guys take a pause, call me when you're sure you want to stay here and go through the pain and expense of remodeling your house. Yeah. And then we can work on it. And I think they appreciate that, because we're trying to help them solve their problems.
They'll come back and they'll refer you to others because you help them with that decision-making.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you said earlier that there's two primary products that LiveCo offers. So we just talked about one. What's this other service, this other product that you offer?
So our second design step, so they can end at feasibility. You know, they can put it on the shelf. I mean, if they really want to, they can take it to somebody else. They can do whatever they want with it. That's the end of our first step commitment. Then we have detailed design, and detailed design is when we do all the architectural documentation. And that's for the purposes of trade walkthroughs, permitting, you know, more formal floor plans and scopes for them to approve. And then our interior design team gets involved in that as well and guides them through all the selections pieces.
All part of that service, right? There's no optional piece in there. That's all part of it.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a great question, because someone asked me yesterday, they're like, well, we have a friend who's an interior designer. Right. Can we use that? I'm like, I think you can, but you still have to pay us to do it, because we're managing it, because our process is getting everything to the build team so that we can build it efficiently, so that we, you know, can procure materials, know how it's going to go together, you know, be able to plan accordingly and not slow down the schedule and make sure we know what it's going to cost.
When they sign on to that second step, are they signing on to construction as well? Are they committing to you as a builder? No.
No, we don't do that until the end.
Okay. So you're doing a design, initial design package, then you're doing detailed design. They have a buildable set at the end of that step?
Kind of, because it's our set. Yep. So our drawing set is designed in the way that we build.
Okay.
So it's less...
So not necessarily biddable to other contractors. It's just a set of drawings that are ready for you to build it.
Right. Yeah. It's in for permitting. So, you know, you're not going to see as much, you know, pardon my French, but cover your ass notes.
Right. Yeah.
I just did a drawing review, and I'm like, this is just making our subs make things more expensive. You know, there's too many words to read.
Right.
You know, because so it's a very simple drawing set. And then we have separate detail sheets that are needed. And then we have a separate selections package. And then that goes into a binder that gets handed off to construction. So if you were to send it out to bid, there might be certain aspects of it that someone could bid as a general, but it wouldn't be necessarily what you would normally see from a regular architect.
So typically when a customer comes to you, they're going through this feasibility study, then they're doing a fully designed design set, and then what happens at the end of that design set? Are you getting paid for that package?
Yes. So detailed design has a separate fee. That's 8% of the budget that comes out of feasibility.
Okay. So they've agreed this is what it's going to cost. It's a, you know, $500,000 project, and then the next phase is based on the percentage of what they agreed that project may cost.
Exactly.
Got it.
Yep.
So it's essentially a flat fee based on the estimated cost of the
correct
space. Got it.
And I've talked about this to a lot of different people, and they're like, well, why did you do that? I'm like, I'm lazy. You know, I'm like, I don't know. I don't like writing proposals. I don't know exactly how long it's going to take. I don't want to do a retainer and, you know, bill them weekly. It's like, if based on my payroll and the volume of work that we have to do, you know, my 8% plus the feasibility fee covers it and is profitable, or should be. Yeah, so that's something that can continually be refined.
Sure.
But that's how we're kind of set up right now.
And again, you're giving the client what they want. The client wants a hard number, right? They want, okay, what does this phase cost?
Right.
If it's 8% of some future number, they're like, oh, that doesn't mean anything to me. But it's 8% of the number that you just agreed that that's the project you want to build. Then they're like, yeah, got it. Okay. 8% of $100,000 is, you know, $8,000. So
exactly.
They're good to go.
Yeah, it's not based on what their budget is, because then they're going to say, well, my budget's $50,000, exactly. So I pay a percentage of that. That doesn't do you any good. Yeah. Now, usually they'll end up spending more during detailed design, you know, design change orders or whatever. The scope will get bigger, you know, so their percentage ends up like a little bit less. You know, I think it averages out probably like 6% at the end of the day, but it works for now.
So at the end of that design phase, then they commit to construction with you?
Yep. So then we have the full construction package or construction contract package. So that's our
the third step.
Yep. Yep. So they sign on to that. And then, you know, we have a regular payment structure and then we start building it. That there's not a whole lot to say about that phase. That's the easy part, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. Right.
And so they go through the feasibility, they go through full design, then they commit to construction and you start construction. You know, obviously all the other things, approvals, all of that is included in one of these phases, right? So how does, where do the approvals fit? In the construction or the design?
So the approvals are in design. Okay. So when we go to contract, that contract package is about 60 pages. It's about 8 pages of actual legal stuff. And the rest is everything that we're putting into this house. So we need to be very, very specific about it. And the pandemic helped with that too, because we have to order cabinets 2 months before we start construction.
Right.
Before we would, and windows. I mean, we used to be able to do demo and then order cabinets and windows. So everything really has to be hashed out and figured out, and all the approvals happen on the design side. And then even in our handoff, we'll go through, are there any open approvals? And then we target when those need to be approved.
How involved is the design team during construction?
Too much. So I mean, we do remodels in old Chicago suburbs, so there's a lot of wild card conditions. Yeah. So what we try and do is identify places where there might be an opportunity to make a design change ahead of time so that we can try and schedule that, because that's one of the hard parts for our interior design team, is they get continually sucked into construction and then they can't focus on the projects that are in detailed design.
Right.
So we have another architect that we actually hired about a year ago, and he is actually on the construction side as project developer. And that's kind of how his role is shaping up, is to be that liaison from design and construction and help connect the dots on that. So everyone,
that process very efficient. Somebody's dedicated to design changes during construction. And the design changes, are they typically because they're existing homes, just design opportunities that sort of pop up during construction that you're taking advantage of? Or are they changes of mind from a client saying, oh, that's not what I wanted, I want this instead?
It's all of the above. So sometimes we'll have something where, I mean, it's usually my fault, where I walk in and I'm like, ooh, you know, it would be really cool here.
Yeah.
And clients like that. I mean, that's another reason they hire us. If we see something that could be better, you know, at least propose it. You know, they know it's going to cost more, it's going to take longer. And we'll say, you know, this might cost more or take longer, but you want to hear it? And they're like, yeah, we want to hear it. So, and those are probably few and far between, because we do try and spend a lot of time in the design phase and solving those things, but you know, it's, you never know. And then, yes, you'll definitely have clients who, will see something and say, you know, what if we move this wall over here or do something like that? Those really don't happen too often either, just because we have spent so much time, right, up front. And then the third part, yeah, unforeseen conditions where we're opening up a ceiling on a 120-year-old house and it's built in the weirdest way that we could ever imagine. Right. And never, ever could have anticipated, and we have to solve that.
Yeah, I've for 20 years I worked in Westchester County, just north of New York City, very similar housing there. And we've opened up ceilings where you expect to see a beam and there's no beam. and you're wondering, how is this house standing up?
We always say they don't build them like they used to for good reason.
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting what you find in old houses. Yeah, super interesting. Before I get to the final question, I have one more question because you've done a good job on your brand, LiveCo, and the way it looks, the way it sounds. When you go to the website, it's very clear. How important is your brand to your success?
Oh, it's huge. Yeah. Our brand is very, very specific. I think even the colors you kind of see, you know, our photographer, the way he kind of does the graininess, and I don't even know what he does to make it kind of have that, you know, leathery vibe, you know, that black and leather or whatever. Yeah. I think it's always been important. And the way we did it is, I think I'm pretty good at designing houses, but I think I'm good at graphic design and branding. I'm not compared to people.
Listen up, architects, because we're all in the same boat. We all think we can design our own logos.
No, and it's like if you meet a graphic designer who thinks he's really good at designing a house.
Right. Yep.
You know, it's like, no, it's two different worlds, and they're just exposed to way more that we haven't even thought about yet. Right. So we commissioned a pretty daggone high-end Chicago marketing company to develop, this is our new one, but I had them develop just, we call it our guidebook, just a marketing piece.
Explain what you're holding so listeners can understand what that is.
Oh, so it's essentially, you know, a little magazine, basically. It walks through our process, has our portfolio. We call it a guidebook. I think it lends a professional angle to what we do. It's not inexpensive to make. It emits what we're trying to bring to the world, you know, inspired design. It's something that you want to look through. It's kind of cool. It has fun stuff in it. It has like a connect the before and afters. So we had a high-end Chicago firm develop just that, because we went to them and we're like, we need some help kind of branding and doing all that stuff. And they're like, all right, where do you want to start? Because it's going to be like $500,000. And we're like, we have 10. So they're like, well, what if we just focus on one piece?
Yep.
And it was invaluable because they developed LiveCo. They figured out what font we needed to use. They wrote really, really good copy. We were then able to take that, apply it to our website, continue to use it in all of our pieces. So that's how we got started, kind of on a budget, is hiring that group to do it. And then
they helped you name the company as well. Live Companies was part of that.
No, Live Companies was my name.
Okay.
And they shortened it to LiveCo.
LiveCo. Got it.
Yeah.
Got it. Where did the name Live Companies come from?
We're going to have a whole nother episode, Mark.
We could do that. Do the short version now, and we'll come back and talk about branding another day.
So when I first started working as an architect, I had a little side LLC, and I called it Live Funner, F-U-N-N-E-R, because I was working in Chicago architecture, and it just wasn't very fun. So I appreciated that. Like the whole idea of like the prickly mountain design build guys, where like we have a 10-foot sheet of plywood and we don't have a saw, so we're just going to let it hang 2 feet over the edge. You know, there was something that I thought was could be like fun about architecture, where it didn't have to be so Meissian and so perfect.
Yeah.
So that's how I created Live Funner. And then when we started LiveCo, we just got rid of the funner, but still want to be focused on living. And LiveCo can do branch out to all kinds of different avenues associated with living. It doesn't just have to be architecture or construction.
Yep. I love it.
Kind of the idea.
And if anybody's looking for the website, it's livecompanies.com, spelled out L-I-V, no E on live, L-I-V-E companies, spelled out .com. You could go check it out, livecompanies.com. Dave, before we wrap up, what's one thing that a small firm architect can do today to build a better business for tomorrow? What's the one thing?
I'm going to talk very business, because we talked about numbers a little bit. Yeah. I don't know how many firms out there as an owner have yourself an overhead.
So if you run your business model and as a owner's salary, you earn overhead and everybody else is billable hours, it will change your life. Because I think too often you count yourself as billable hours and you're basically just making a job for yourself. And it's going to be very, very difficult to grow. So I don't know if you agree with that, Mark, but run that Excel spreadsheet model, put owner salary, whatever you need to make to be happy, in overhead, and then figure out what you need to charge.
Yeah, I love that. Very interesting. His name is Dave Pollard. The company again is Live Companies. The website is livecompanies.com. Dave, thanks for coming by here and sharing your story, sharing some inspiration about how you built Live Companies. It is a model that so many architects are looking for. They want to do what you've done. We've also learned how hard it has been to get to where you are. So I appreciate you for sharing that story and for coming by here and sharing your knowledge at Entree Architect Podcast.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks, Mark. Really appreciate it.
If you liked this episode of Entree Architect Podcast, please share a rating, write a review, and share a link to this episode with a friend. That's how Entree Architect has grown to serve thousands more architects just like you. Share a rating, write a review, and share a link to this episode with a friend. Links to our sponsors and all the resources we discussed today are available at the show notes for this episode found at entrearchitect.com/podcast. Entree Architect is a member of the Gable Media Podcast Network, the network dedicated to architects, engineers, and construction pros. Listen and subscribe to all the shows at gablemedia.com. That's gablemedia.com. And visit smallfirmconference.com for more information about our lineup of speakers, check out the agenda, and purchase your tickets for the Entree Architect Community Annual Meeting, the business conference for small firm entrepreneur architects. We do have a few tickets still available, but we're almost sold out. So visit smallfirmconference.com and register today. And before we wrap up, a special thank you to our partners at Graphisoft for helping our community of architects make the transition to BIM with ArchiCAD software. Go now to graphisoft.com/US/EntreeArchitect and see how Graphisoft is positioned to help make your architecture firm a success. Visit graphisoft.com/US/EntreeArchitect to learn more. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Entree Architect Podcast. My name is Mark Arla Page. Love, learn, and share what you know.
From historic homes to modern architecture, brick is one of the most popular building materials around the world.
How to allow the house to bridge the gap between the history of the site, the approachability of this kind of architecture in this kind of neighborhood, and the sort of nostalgia of materiality for the client's past, right? And brick really started to provide an answer for that.
Hi, I'm Doug Pat, and this is Design Vault. There aren't many materials that easily blend with any style and context, but brick does just that. I've seen some extraordinary work with brick, so when Glengarry approached me about hosting this podcast, I couldn't say no.
Typically, Tudor-style houses from outside are just stunningly gorgeous piece of structure. And when you go in, it's just sad.
Yeah.
Dark. And that is not going to happen with my approach to design.
I speak with industry leaders and share inspiring stories behind their work and ingenious design.
You'll see brick that's fashioned into basket weave patterns, sawtooth patterns, what's known in England as diapering.
Doesn't sound like you knew them per se, right? They found you through relationships that you had with other.
Well, wait, Doug, there's more.
Okay.
We'll go behind the scenes to understand process and even the inspiration that sparked the design.
You know, I think we were inspired by all the factory buildings in Dumbo. I mean, that is the kind of period of significance, that early American factory building.
Design Vault by Glengarry. Visit glengarry.com/design-vault or search for Design Vault wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe now to stretch your imagination.
Attention architects and creative minds, get ready to supercharge your brand with Build Your Brand, the podcast that's unlocking the secrets of branding success for creatives. Hey there, it's Mark Arlepage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my friend, architect marketing expert, Jeff Eccles at Build Your Brand podcast, where he explores the captivating stories of the world's top brands and transforms their lessons into powerful moves for small firm architects and creatives like you. In season one, Jeff shares the thrilling tale of Southwest Airlines, where he dissects their journey to the summit and distills it into strategies tailor-made for you.
It's important to keep in mind that companies like Southwest compete in the real world, just like you, and face real-world challenges, just like you. You might be surprised at how similar those challenges are to the struggles that you grapple with on a day-to-day basis.
Don't miss out on your blueprint for success. Subscribe, tune in, and let's build your brand together.
You may have noticed that the very best brands in the world are also known for having somewhat unique corporate cultures. That's often the glue that holds everything together when they encounter those rough spots.
We don't do it because it inconveniences the passengers to whom we are primarily dedicated, the short-haul frequent flyer.
Follow the link in the show notes to subscribe to Build Your Brand today. Remember, no matter the size, the journey's the same. Your brand's journey to the top starts here.